The Tom Woods Show, episode 828.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Men, if you want to dress for success, you can't just grab a suit off the rack. You got to have a suit made for you. This week, my listeners can get any premium Indochino suit for just $389 at Indochino.com when entering Woods at checkout. Hello, everybody. Tom Woods here. There are a bunch of Federal Reserve reform proposals out there. There have been proposals bandied about for years as to how the Fed ought to be fixed or modified. And there are proposals from the populist left and from the right and from the middle. And there are some actually that are being considered right now in Washington. And I wanted to make sense of these and see if any of them would actually amount to anything or be a good idea. And joining us to talk about this topic is the author of a couple recent articles on just that, and that's Tho Bishop, who is the director of the Mises Institute's social media marketing, and he also served as deputy communications director of the House Financial Services Committee. So he's got a lot of knowledge and insider information about the way Washington works, and I thought let's get to the bottom of this with Tho Bishop. Tho, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me, Tom. It's a great honor.
We got some articles and interesting topics to discuss. I want to get your background first because it's interesting. You were deputy communications director with the House Financial Services Committee. I guess in the back of my mind, even though I know you had told me that, I still had it in the back of my mind that somehow you were in Ron Paul's office.
I got to help a lot with Ron Paul's office. And, he was subcommittee chairman for the Domestic Monetary Policy subcommittee. And so, I got to work a lot with them. And I kind of consider myself the Austrian mole in the full committee. I did deal with doing the morning clips for the congressman. So I try to slide in Mises Institute content or, the occasional article from Zero Hedge. Worked with the media a lot and then helped with research for some of Dr. Paul's hearings. So it was, great experience being able to interact in the full committee. I'm trying to get these eyes, get these ideas out there and some of the, the policy wonks and that sort of stuff that were, working for the Financial Services Committee.
When was this that you were there?
I came in right after the Tea Party kind of came in and took over. So it was actually Congressman Spencer Backus. He's the one that brought me in 2011. And then I stayed over when Jeb Hensarling took over and then left second half of 2013.
And now you're actually with the Mises Institute full time.
Yes. Living the dream, coming in the best organization in the world and living here in Auburn, which growing up as a Georgia Bulldog fan, it's taken me a while to get used to all the blue and orange up here. But, working the best place in the world.
Well, yeah. Where else would anybody want to work? If you were going to work full time somewhere, that's where you'd want to be. Well, it's amazing to me that somebody who would want to work at the Mises Institute full time came into a position like that via someone other than Ron Paul. That's why I just assumed there had to be some connection.
Well, it was very interesting. To Congressman Backus's credit, he's by no means an Austrian at all. But, I was able to have a meeting with him. I used to do campaign work for him. And then I started talking about, hey, have you heard about these crazy Austrians that were predicting everything before it happened? And and he was very interested. So I gave him a book by Bob Murphy. I actually gave him some of your articles. He asked me to talk more about this sort of stuff. And so, I don't think he ever fully bought on. He was still complaining about, who would build the roads. While I was working for him, but he was open. He enjoyed the fact that I had a kind of different perspective, and it was great being able to bring that into kind of a different environment up in D.C.
Yeah. And by the way, on that whole roads thing, I know they being people who disagree with us are the ones who bring that up. But all the same, I guess I always think if I would be inclined strategically to concede the roads to people at the beginning and say, all right, look, how about this? I'll let you have the roads and I'll let you have these other things, but listen to what I'm saying on 99% of society. And I bet you by the time you agree with me on those things, you'll figure out this. Obviously, there's going to be some way we'll figure out how to lay down some guitar, you know, that will not seem like such an insuperable obstacle once I'm done with you on everything else. All right, let's talk about the Fed here,
yes.
Because there is some talk about reforms to the Fed, I guess. And I haven't followed them. I don't know what the details are. I know at least there's some talk about some kind of rule-based reform that would make the Fed's policy less discretionary, let's say, that would presumably rein in the Fed a bit. Tell us a little bit about what's on the table right now.
Well, there's a few different proposals. You know, both the House tends to be a little bit more aggressive, and the Senate is always trying to slow things down a little bit. It was interesting, actually, when Jeb Hensarling took over in 2013, we had a big staff meeting, and to my great surprise, he was laying out his priorities for his term, and the third thing he listed was, I want to go after the Fed and I want to reform it. Again, he's not quite an Austrian, but he's read at least a little bit of Hayek, and he knew who Ludwig von Mises was. So kind of from that, since he's taken over, he's pushed what's called the Form Act. And everything that he does has this, clever, sort of acronym to it. So he's got the Form Act. And unfortunately, it's this big flirtation with rules-based policy. These are the sort of people they always bring in John Taylor to come in for like every single Fed hearing they have. And their whole belief is that, hey, look, if we just give the Fed, this set of rules, then, we don't have to worry about, all these, shenanigans going on, and that's the best way to rein it in. So basically what the Form Act would do is that it doesn't set a particular type of rule. Usually it's associated with John Taylor just because he keeps showing up in congressional hearings. But it would just require the Fed to set a rule. Tell Congress what rule it sets, explain anytime it changes from it. It has a few tweaks to kind of the oversight of the Fed. It would require a few more congressional hearings. It does include Ron Paul's audit. So that is currently included in the House side. And that's really kind of the real core of the Form Act on the House side. On the Senate side, you have Senator Shelby. And his act is a little bit a little bit different. Really, it's kind of all focused on changing the dynamics of the Board of Governors. And this is interesting because you've seen this kind of pop up in the last year from Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren that, if we just make the Board of Governors more representative of the people, if we had more minorities in here, or if we had less bankers and that sort of stuff, then that's going to get a better result from the Fed. So that's really the core side of what the Senate's trying to do. It doesn't have any rule requirement yet, though that's been talked about in the past. It does not include a Fed audit. And of course, that's the Senate side is always where the audit of the Fed bill has gone to die. It's got enough support in the House side now, but there's just too many senators, especially even Republican side, that just they're completely bought into the whole Fed independence narrative. But with now Donald Trump coming in, making it very clear that he's as clear as he can be that, he's open to Fed reform stuff. It seems that the pieces are on the table for something to get done. And chances are, I think you're going to end up getting a kind of a middle ground between these two proposals.
What do you think in general about these proposals? By the way, the Taylor rule, named after John Taylor, is something that we've covered here on the show, and it's been covered at the Mises website. Matt Mahai in Poland has done a really good paper dismantling the so-called Taylor rule. The idea of the Taylor rule is, we talk about it in great detail, but the idea is that it would make the Fed's policy less discretionary and that if we had followed it, we would have avoided the financial crisis. And Matt shows that that's actually not true. And it really is a Rube Goldberg kind of contraption. It's a way to just avoid the idea that maybe the market ought to just set interest rates. As soon as you get away from that, you wind up with these crazy things masquerading as free market policies like the Taylor rule. So I'm going to link at tomwoods.com/828 to the episode we did on that. So looking at these proposals, do you think this is a case of these proposals might be a tiny step forward, but we could do better? Or do you think there are some ways in which these proposals might wind up being no change at all, or maybe even self-defeating in some way? Give me your opinion.
Well, my big concern is largely opportunity cost. Because, the thing is, the fact that we've gotten to this point where people are actually talking about the Fed and the fact that it's broken, that's a beautiful, it's all been built up from this conversation stemming from 2008 and Ron Paul's campaign, the financial crisis, on, hey, monetary policy matters. and it has consequences. And so if we have, you know, especially, you know, what I find interesting is that some of the people that are out there backing it are, you know, like Cato and the Mercatus Center in D.C. You know, when you have libertarians in D.C., you know, stepping alongside with Republican legislators looking to reform the Fed. Well, then my concern is that we're not that this topic's not going to come back up for, you know, barring until you know, next major financial crisis or whatever, that, you can possibly make an argument that some of these are an improvement upon, you know, what James Grant likes to call the PhD standard or the PhD standard we have right now in the Fed. That's all completely arbitrary by the people you know, put in place there. But you know, to me, they all miss the point for exactly, the reasons that, you're just criticizing the Taylor rule. You know, none of the people working on Fed reform understand the real issue. They don't understand the role that interest rates play in the economy. And so to me, I think what we need right now is for opinion and for people to realize that, look, there's another alternative to all of this that has already been put on the table, that has been introduced into has been introduced by the Congress. Ron Paul, with his Currency Competition Act. And Paul Brown is a congressman from Georgia. He took it up later. He got kicked out. But we need more. We need a Thomas Massie. We need a Justin Amash going out there and trying to make the case that, hey, instead of trying to put all of our eggs in the basket of trying to create some sort of rule that will restrain the Fed, if we just simply give competition to it, if we take away the way it's treated as, from a tax standpoint, if we take away legal tender laws, then we don't have to really worry ourselves about what the Fed does, because it will allow competition from Bitcoin, from gold, from silver, from any of these other outlets out there. The market can create competition. And unfortunately, that message since Ron Paul left and since Paul Brown left the next term has not been existent in D.C. because none of these other organizations are talking about it within that Beltway bubble.
Yeah, I'm looking at your Business Insider article. And by the way, I agree completely that if we're going to spend our time working on this question, might as well ask for everything to have the best proposal we could possibly come up with, rather than going in there already compromising. You start with the maximalist demand and then you compromise down if necessary. You don't walk in there with a compromise.
Right.
You walk in there with the best thing you can ask for. I find it interesting, by the way, that you were able to get an article in Business Insider. I mean, once in a while they run non-ideological things that are interesting, but I find them just unreadable. I just cannot even read Business Insider. How did that happen? Is it your old contacts from D.C.? How did you make that happen?
No, it's actually great. Business Insider actually reached out to the Mises Institute looking for additional content. And since, we're happy to share our content with anyone who wants to republish it. They'll regularly syndicate Mises Institute articles. And then the Daily Caller, which, now with Tucker Carlson being the king of cable news, that was one of his outlets. And, they had interest in the issue, too. So that was again, all of this is a testament to, the success Ron Paul had where, talking about the Federal Reserve isn't a crazy, overly wonkish issue.
Now, let's talk about the idea of rules for the Fed. I mean, mm-hmm. We glided over that a bit, but you hit that in the Business Insider article about why we shouldn't expect much from the idea that we'll just set some rules or we'll let the Fed set some rules. Some rules will exist, and this will maybe keep things in line and not let the Fed get out of hand. Why should we not expect much from that?
Well, I mean, for one thing, throughout the history of government, rules are meant to be broken. It's the case with the Constitution, with the way, things are not the way the founders intended. We see this all the time in monetary policy. You constantly have this argument about whether the Fed is actually, fulfilling its dual mandate that it has going on now, which is itself a type of rule. Just last year, the IMF changed overnight its loan quality standards because, they really, really wanted to make a deal with the Ukraine. They didn't fit it. So, when the going gets tough, the rulemakers will just throw the rules out. So at the end of the day, what really matters is not whatever arbitrary rules are in place or what the letter of the law is. It's what are the guiding ideas of the policymakers? Because if they're convinced that, we're facing the next great depression. If you have, you had in 2007, 2008 with Hank Paulson, on his knees begging people and scaring them to death that their children are going to be, living in some Mad Max dystopian world without, a TARP bailout. Then at the end of the day, those are going to change. And so they're really just it's a temporary, they're trying to get credit for doing something with having, I think the long term, no meaningful consequence to the real issues at bay. And what's interesting here is that while all of the focus has usually been on the Taylor rule in the past, there's really a wide bipartisan consensus kind of building separately for NGDP targeting. Which is a different sort of rule, and one that I find even more. Bob Murphy's tackled it several times. Sean Rittenhauer has a wonderful takedown of it on the Mises Institute website. But that's a whole nother set of rules that I don't think some of the House members are going to be particularly happy with. But when you have Christina Romer, Obama's first one of Obama's first economic appointees with now on the same side with Cato and Mercatus pushing this sort of stuff, I think it's very interesting that to me that's where the winds are going. It's not to the Taylor rule, which is really only supported by Republicans. It's this NGDP targeting side, which I think is really concerning.
All right. We're going to talk about what NGDP targeting is in just a minute. I did an episode with Joe Salerno on it, but it was all the way back in episode 361. And I don't want to just assume everybody listened to that episode, right? Although doggone it, they darn well should. Before we do that, let's thank our sponsor. Folks, there comes a time in a man's life when he decides he's not going to buy any more ill-fitting suits off the $99 clearance rack. But at the same time, you don't have to put yourself in the poorhouse to dress for success and to dress to impress. At Indochino, you get a high-quality suit made to your exact measurements for a perfect fit. So you go to Indochino.com, you pick from hundreds of fabrics, choose your customizations from lapels to pleats to jacket linings, all kinds of things. You submit your body measurements, you place your order, and in 4 weeks, you have a suit that was made for you. This week, my listeners can get any premium Indochino suit for just $389 at Indochino.com when entering Woods at checkout. That's 50% off the regular price for a made-to-measure premium suit, plus shipping is free. You wear a suit like this, you're going to feel like the man you want to be. So check out Indochino.com and use promo code Woods for any premium suit for just $389 plus free shipping. Okay, we were talking about something called NGDP targeting, which is a nominal GDP targeting, which is a proposed rule for monetary policy. And as I say, I've discussed it on the show. I'm going to link to it at tomwoods.com/828, the page for this episode. But can you at least explain why somebody who favors that would think that's a good idea? And there are people who consider themselves to be free market economists who say this should be the Fed's policy. They should target NGDP in there. They shouldn't have these other targets. They shouldn't do this or that. They should be aiming at total spending. So why? What is that, and why should they do that?
Well, some of the simplest arguments are simply that, for one, it's something that the Fed can, in their mind, directly control. So it's not quite like, with the dual mandate now, where you're trying to control inflation and you're trying to control the unemployment rate at the same time. This is something that they have the tools. That they can push spending up and with inflation, that sort of stuff. Then also just simply gives a very steady guide. It's very easy pass fail sort of measurement. Either NGDP has hit their targeted level or it hasn't. Just kind of from that, it has those, that's sort of superficial value. Which again, that's in Washington, that's always very attractive. And so that's just, that's a lot of the appeal, and it's again, but the whole idea that, we're going to let the Fed kind of just dictate and just aim at some arbitrary target that they're going to come up with. It strikes me as bizarre that you have any sort of libertarians out there that see, having the central bank just arbitrarily set something is that at all a real solution to what ails us right now? I mean, it seems like just another example of a fatal conceit.
Do you have any – how long were you at the – did you work at the committee?
About 3 years.
Okay, that's a long time. Do you have any recollections or any anecdotes from those days that might be revealing? I remember hearing stories about the ignorance of people on the committee, for example. But does anything jump to mind as, that episode really summed up my experience in Washington?
For one thing, none of the congressmen have any, any knowledge about monetary policy at all. And it's interesting, actually, the guy that's now has Ron Paul's old job, a guy named Bill Huizenga, I mean, he would never show up for Ron Paul's hearings. You know, but, you know, it, what's important to understand this is that, you know, most of the people that end up on the Financial Services Committee aren't there because they have a knowledge of financial services. You know, there was one great example. It's, there was a woman from New York that got elected. Her name was Nan Hayworth. Wonderful, wonderful woman. But she got elected in 2010 because she was a doctor, and Obamacare was very big. And so, you know, she got elected. All of a sudden, the Republican House, they saw this, you know, female Republican, you know, congresswoman from a moderate district, and they wanted to make sure that she got elected in the next election. So they put her on Financial Services Committee because that was really good for fundraising. And it gave, you know, gave her some, you know, relevant to some of her constituents back home. And but she had no background in banking at all. You know, she to her credit, she had read one economics book, Economics in One Lesson, that her dad asked her to read. But so in order to fill that gap, she hired a staffer from Wall Street that was her top financial services guy. And so, you know, whereas she, because of she had that background with Haslick, she would end up, you know, having some good ideas by just hiring someone with a Wall Street background. She ended up voting for all sorts of weird things that came up. And she ended up, in spite of all that, she still ended up losing the next election. So, you know, everything in D.C., especially in the Financial Services Committee, is so staffer driven. And that's one of the great benefits that Ron Paul had, is that his staff, you know, they went home and they read, you know, Mises and Hayek for fun. But most Congress, you know, most congressional staffers aren't like that. They are usually come from industry, and or if, you know, they'll read something on you know, Forbes or Business Insider, just kind of act like they know what they're talking about. But it's incredible how much control that staffers have within the whole thing. And unfortunately, it also makes congressmen. Very, you know, they're in awe shock. You know, they're always awestruck whenever, you know, you have someone like Ben Bernanke come in and talk to them. You know, they would have every twice a year, they'd have these private dinners with the Financial Services Committee and the staff and Ben Bernanke, and they would talk about different things. And every time Audit the Fed would come up, and he would absolutely just spill it out, like, look, you know, this bill's nothing. We audit ourselves. You know, this is all just an attack on our you know, precious independence, and they bought it because they just weren't willing to argue with, you know, Ben Bernanke, and so you know, there is no Fed independence. If the Fed comes in lobbying something, then just the congressmen themselves, they're not like Ron Paul. They don't read this stuff for fun. They don't have this background, and so they can be completely won over. You know, just by, you know, the appeal of authority and that sort of lobbying. But luckily, you know, every once in a while you did have little wins. You know, I remember, like, for my favorite, the highlight of my entire congressional career was with Ron Paul's last hearing with Ben Bernanke, where, you know, I started noticing that, hey, look, you know, during hearings, you know, back, you know, you have the ability to give time to another member. So if you're in a hearing and you don't really care about the topic, but, you know, your buddy, where this issue is really important to the sister back home, you know, you can show up, give him your 5 minutes and walk off and not do anything. It was just a way of trading favors and that sort of stuff. Well, nobody was doing this for big profile hearings because everyone wanted their time on TV. And usually CNBC would pick up, you know, a Fed hearing or something like that. And so then I realized, you know, with Ron Paul leaving, and luckily, you know, with Walter Jones, you know, one of the greatest men in Congress still there. You know, I gave the idea to Lydia Mashburn, who's actually with Cato now, you know, saying, hey, look, you know, wouldn't it be great if we got Ron Paul an extra 5 minutes with Ben Bernanke during his last hearing? And so she loved the idea. She went to Walter Jones' people, and yeah, kind of worked it out where Walter Jones ceded his 5 minutes to Ron Paul, and it was great being in the room because, you know, everyone, no one was caring. After Ron Paul was done, they thought the fireworks were over, and then when Walter Jones said, you know, I cede my time to my good friend, the man that should be president, you know, Ron Paul, every reporter's head on the table, you know, just jerked up, and nobody saw it coming. And I don't think Ben Bernanke particularly liked that. But every once in a while, you know, working within the system, you can have some fun. You like Bill Green being able to get Ron Paul electoral vote from Texas last year. You know, every once in a while, you can get little gains to get the ideas out there.
When you left What were the circumstances? Were you booted out or did you leave on your own?
Actually, I left to run for State House down in Florida, actually.
Oh, what part?
Panama City. So District 6, it's in the Panhandle. Southern Alabama, as the Redneck Riviera, as sometimes we like to call it. But yeah, it was that itself was a whole nother experience. But since I ended up working at the Mises Institute, you know, I may have lost the election, but I won the war. So
yeah. Great. So all right. Well, what final words would you leave? I mean, I'm going to link to your articles, the two articles that I've been reading from Daily Caller and Business Insider, at tomwoods.com/828. But any final thoughts, anything I overlooked in trying to get to this, I give you the floor.
Okay. Well, again, just the main thing is just understanding that, you know, why competition and currencies matter. You know, for all it's a, you know, there's a lot of great things that can come out of auditing the Fed, for example. You know, that they're engaged in all sorts of bad things. It'd be great to get some of that stuff out in the light. But at the end of the day, you know, we had a very limited Federal Reserve audit, actually, because of Dodd-Frank. And a lot of bad things were revealed in that. But that didn't really move the needle. You know, so I think any hope of, you know, if we just shine a light on what the Fed is really doing, then that's going to get out the pitchforks and the torches, and that's what's going to change things. You know, personally, I'm pessimistic on that. But if we were able to get just a little bit of movement for getting competition in the market for money, if we can, you know, the beautiful thing about this is that it's a boring bill. You know, it's not radical like ending the Fed. It doesn't step on Fed independence like out of the Fed, as they would argue. That this is the sort of thing that could be easily slipped into just about any bill up there. And if it happened, it'd be the most radical thing that has ever happened to monetary policy in America since, you know, at least, you know, since we went off the gold and, you know, went purely to a fiat currency. So just getting people talking about it, realizing that's important, to talking to members, to your own congressmen. You know, I think one of the great things that has impacted the way generic Republican views monetary policy is that when congressmen go back home, they actually do. You usually have that one person with a pocket constitution saying, "Why aren't we auditing the Fed?" Having that sort of grassroots pressure, I think, could possibly get something like Ron Paul's competition currency bill passed. Because it hits all those, you know, it hits states' rights, it hits the beauty of the market, it hits these sort of things that Republicans like to pretend that they believe in. And so if we can just get that idea out there more, then given that we're going to be talking about Fed reform, I think, for the next couple of years, it presents a great opportunity for us to make a real gain in that battle. And so just, you know, don't fall for rules-based monetary policy. Don't fall for, you know, fall for what Cato's trying to put out there. Don't fall for Mercatus. This is the real path out there to getting beyond the Fed and to getting to putting something real back behind our money.
Well, definitely people should check out. I'm going to have great resources at tomwoods.com/828. Your articles plus episodes I've done on NGDP targeting and on what was the other one? The Taylor Rule. These
yes.
are both things you got to know about to have an informed opinion on this stuff. So that'll all be there. Well, thanks a lot, Tho. It's great talking to you. And I don't know if I'm going to be able to get up there for the conference in March, but I'll be up there one of these days. It's nice to be a mere, 7.5 hour drive away. That's at least doable. So thanks again.
Yeah, thank you, Tom.
All right, everybody. I got a cute little thing to tell you about here. Last night, I went to what's called an escape room with some of the supporting listeners of the show in Orlando, and it was a great time, and we escaped. Now, if you've not heard of these, you should Google it and go try one, because the chances are there's at least one in a city near you. The idea is you're locked in a room for an hour, and you got to figure out ways to get out. And there are clues and puzzles. You got to solve these puzzles and work together to get out. And we did one at Escape Room Entertainment. The website is iescapedorlando.com. And it was just great fun. You have an hour to get out. We got out with more than 17 minutes to spare. Absolutely great. And so I got to know, I had not met most of those people before. I got to know some great folks. And I paid for everybody as a gesture of thanks, because I genuinely appreciate people who support the show. And I give a lot of goodies to people who support the show. It's not just you get a warm feeling. Yeah, you can get warm feelings all kinds of terrible ways. No. I give you actual stuff. So transcripts of all the interviews I do, my private Facebook group, the Tom Woods Show Elite. You can't even find it on Facebook. It's so secret. I let you in there. 60% off at libertyclassroom.com. Discounts at all kinds of Liberty retailers. I give you the Kindle version of my book, Real Dissent. And then depending on your level, I give you my 31-lecture course from Liberty Classroom, What's Wrong with Textbook Economics. I give you signed books. In some cases, I give you the Ron Paul curriculum videos. It is unbelievable. It's shocking. So if you've been enjoying the show, here we are in episode 828. And if you feel like it's been of some benefit to you, I hope you will consider joining me at supportinglisteners.com. That's my own site, by the way. Isn't that clever? Nobody had taken supportinglisteners.com. I thought that up. And when you hear it, people think, oh, that must be a site where a lot of podcasters get support from their listeners. No. Nope, that's just me, supportinglisteners.com. That's my little program. So if you like the show, you feel like it benefits you, you're getting something out of it, then I would be very happy to welcome you as a supporting listener, get you in that Facebook group. But even if you don't like Facebook, I got so many other benefits, you won't even notice that you're not in there. I mean, there are so many benefits. So please do check that out at supportinglisteners.com. Tomorrow, I'm not quite sure what I'm going to do, but I got some interesting guests lined up for, let's see, Friday and then early next week. We're going to get Jay Richards back on the show. Remember, we talked to him about J.R.R. Tolkien and Liberty. We're going to talk about a whole different topic with him. I got some good stuff coming up. Plus, that whole topic about the men's rights movement, that generated a lot of controversy, even among my listeners. So I'm going to revisit that sometime next week as well. So lots of fun stuff. Plus, a guest, Milo Yiannopoulos himself, recommended to me. He emailed me and said, you've got to have this guy on. So I thought, well, one thing I know, it won't be boring if Milo is recommending the guest. So fun stuff coming up next week. I hope you'll stick around and listen. Thanks for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.